From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. This week, Michael Phelps became the winningest Olympian of all time. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll discuss Phelps' achievements and a cadre of other Olympic topics with John Powers. Also, how the Olympics are changing China's sports culture, and a conversation with Mark Kreidler, author of Six Good Innings, How One Small Town Became a Little League Giant. Also ahead, exploring the Olympic shell game that transports athletes from nation to nation, including Caribbean American Andrew Howe, now a long jumper for Italy.
I think like an Italian, I act like an Italian, I speak like an Italian. When you feel that it's inside yourself and it's in your heart, I don't think it really has to be inside your blood.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The images of jumping, leaping, bouncing will endure, as will the wins of Michael Phelps. There may be even more. We've still got finals to enjoy in various team sports, and doubtless there will be surprises to all kinds and sorts. And there among the fireworks, the medals, and the flowers, we join the globe's Olympics guy. He's our guy, too, John Powers. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Ni hao, Bill. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Michael Phelps failed to set a world record in the 100 fly last night. Bummer. But he did earn his seventh gold medal of these games. Still, you think Phelps and family were a little bit let down?
Well, I think what was interesting is that Michael won a race that was impossible to win. He won it by 1/100th of a second over Milorad Kavic, who he really couldn't even spell him. It was the most dramatic moment here. Michael was seventh at the turn, came and basically was still out of the water when Kavic appeared to be at the wall. So the lesson here is never get a manicure before the Olympics.
Never get a manicure. I have to remember that one in case I ever make the team. All right, you've covered the Olympics since the Spinks brothers were spinking and Dorothy Hamill was cameling. That was 1976 for our younger listeners. I'm sure you can offer some perspective on Michael Phelps' career. Is he the greatest Olympian ever?
I believe he is. I mean, just to be able not just to win the medals, and he's certainly favored to win his eighth in the relay on Saturday night, U.S. time, but to be able to do it in all of the strokes and to go 17 races, that is how many he will do if you count heats and semis and finals, to be able to go every day, every night the way he has done, and also to be able to do it against specialists has been quite impressive.
Michael Phelps has said that he will compete in London in 2012 and perhaps even in the 2016 games. One wonders if he'll have anything left in the tank after this effort.
Well, I think Michael, it's funny, he keeps saying, you know, eight gold medals isn't my fantasy, that's your guy's fantasy. What he likes is challenges. As a matter of fact, before his seventh gold medal, Bob Bowman, his coach, trying to get him jacked up a bit, you know, it wouldn't be bad for you to lose a race. And that's all Michael needed to hear, was that his coach thought that, you know, he might not want the eight. What'll be interesting about Michael is his real fantasy is to swim the 50-meter freestyle, and his coach won't let him. So I think he will stay alive in the sport as long as he can do that. He wants that gold medal in the 50.
The team and the individual all-round gymnastics competitions offered much in the way of drama. Of course, China won the team competition this week, but the U.S. subsequently won gold and silver in the all-round. How do you see the event finals playing out starting tomorrow?
Well, I think you've got a number of chances more for the Americans. Of course, the one that everyone is watching, of course, is Alicia Sacramone, who had the unfortunate day on beam and floor. She still has a chance at a gold medal in the vault. So basically, she's got about 15 seconds to glory, and she may well do it. Of course, Nastia Liukin has three more chances at gold medals, and Sean Johnson, too. They may well be able to top what they did in Athens when the U.S. team as a whole won nine medals. What's interesting, of course, about the all-around final between Liukin and Johnson, they are roommates in the Olympic Village. It's the first time American girls ever had a sleepover with medals after breakfast the next day, and wish each other good luck.
Well, it seems to me the critical thing about the remaining gymnastics competition is you got to hold them after the bedtime of the Chinese competitors, right? I mean, what's the story with what are you hearing about the ages of these Chinese competitors?
Well, everyone thinks that at least three of them are underage, especially Hay, who is their bar specialist. Marta Caroli from Romania, who knows underage gymnasts, having seen a few back in the day, she says, you know, all I know is the little girl is missing a tooth. So when in doubt, what they needed was bring in the dentists.
Athletics, otherwise known as track and field, began yesterday. How does athletics match the drama that we've gotten from swimming and gymnastics?
Well, I think, of course, we'll have the big drama in the men's 100-meter final when Mr. Gay goes up against a whole bunch of Jamaicans. But the event everyone in China is waiting for is the hurdles. It was the only gold medal that they won in track and field in Athens. Lu Shang against Aaron Robles from Cuba.
You mentioned the men's 100-meter event, which, of course, takes place tonight. This is the race that will determine the world's fastest man. Still one of the most anticipated races at the Games?
Absolutely. This is one, and especially for the U.S., this is how Americans judge their games. Did we win the men's 100? There was a very famous course headline in 1972 when Valery Borisov won it for the Soviet Union. It was, the world's fastest man is a commie. So clearly this... So clearly, this is one that the Americans feel they have to have. They thought that they were going to get it with Justin Gatlin this time. Gatlin, of course, can't run. Now it's up to Mr. Gay to do it, and, of course, up against a whole bunch of Jamaicans. So this is certainly going to be the most interesting race so far. But the one everyone in China is looking for is the men's hurdles with Lu Shang against the Cuban Mr. Robles, who has taken away his world record. If they lose that, the country goes into mourning. That's the one they feel they have to have.
On Thursday, Mongolia won its first ever gold medal, that being in judo. On Tuesday, Benjamin Bukpeti brought Olympic glory to Togo by taking bronze in the men's kayak competition. Which other formerly medalless nations might shock the world over the next 9 days?
Well, a big one here is Canada. Actually had no medals at all until today. They got one in rowing. Still don't have a gold medal. And the joke was that Michael Phelps was willing to give them two of his golds for Manitoba.
It seems a fair treat. John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe, and we're fortunate that he joins us here at Only a Game as well, every Olympiad. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Bill.
Video footage of Chinese citizens going through daily exercise routines en masse has given Western audiences the impression that China is a nation that promotes healthy habits for its citizens. But while in Beijing, reporter Ann Donahue has discovered that's only partly true.
Every morning in China, millions of people go out to the parks and practice Tai Chi, the slow, smooth, flowing martial art that emphasizes balance and grace.
I'm getting older and older. I'm 67 years old, and there was something wrong with me, and I couldn't sleep. But I started practicing Tai Chi, and now I am much healthier than before.
Interest in Tai Chi has spread beyond the older generation and has younger practitioners in China and around the world. Huang Xiaofen is a college student in Beijing, and she's been doing Tai Chi for 2 years.
After hard working of the whole day, we can practice Tai Chi, and it makes us relaxing. You can be refreshed.
But after the Tai Chi enthusiasts leave the park, and most of the country has gone off to work and school, the parks fill again, this time with older women. The women perform different sorts of dances, sometimes using flags or fans, other times clapping wooden blocks or snapping chopsticks in their hands. This dancing goes on all day and into the evening. The nighttime dance, called yanga, resembles something more like country western line dances. Beijing is also dotted with hundreds of little exercise parks, kind of like mini playgrounds for adults, with colorful metal machines, including treadmills, weight-resistance pulleys, and stationary bikes. Running tracks on university campuses are jammed with joggers and walkers until late into the night, and basketball is a seemingly 24-hour game. The overall impression from all this public outdoor activity is that China is a nation on the move, literally, and that physical fitness is a national obsession. But Susan Brownell, a University of Missouri professor and anthropologist who has been studying Chinese sports for 20 years, says what you see is not necessarily an indication of a more physically fit country, and that one reason for all the outside activity is China's lack of indoor facilities.
The main spaces available are parks, and of course, a lot of the public places are not even exactly parks, but just, you know, islands in the middle of the lanes of a highway or, you know, whatever space they can find. And that has been actually a cause for some discontent over the years. You know, there have been occasions when some of those Yangge groups organized a low-scale protest to request that they be given gymnasiums or facilities to use indoor facilities. And as a result, a ban against Yangge was enacted in the entire city in the mid-1990s.
Brownell says most of the Chinese investment in sport has gone to training elite athletes, not in providing facilities for the general population. Western sports are a relatively recent import to China, brought in by missionaries in the YMCA about 100 years ago. Miao Wei, the editor of China's largest weekly magazine, Life Weekly, wrote a recent cover story on Western influence in Chinese sport.
There's no tradition of team sports in China. Here, exercise was traditionally to achieve inner balance. But at the beginning of the 20th century, the Germans introduced acrobatics and gymnastics to China so that Chinese people could become stronger in order to strengthen our military forces.
Over the past century, soccer, basketball, and other Western sports have gradually gained in popularity here. But all sports have suffered from a lack of infrastructure. Now, many of the venues that have been built for the Beijing Games will become property of local universities or communities. Again, Susan Brownell.
An issue that we will be seeing after the Olympic Games are over is that this large number of new, really incredible arenas that's been built will really, for the first time, provide a base of facilities that are located, most of them are in universities, which are not going to be dedicated to this state-supported sports system. And the universities are going to have to learn how to manage them and try to make them financially viable. We don't know whether they'll be made open to the public, completely open to the public or not, but certainly they should be more open than the previous training facilities were. And at a very minimum, they should, we hope, contribute to the development of sports inside the universities.
But Brownell warns that with greater prosperity, there may actually be a decline in physical fitness. Brownell first came to Beijing in the 1980s as an exchange student and became a national track and field champion for China. Back then, bikes were ubiquitous and food was rationed. She remembers that obesity in China was almost unheard of. But today, there are many fewer bikes on the roads, elevators are more prevalent, and fattening foods are much more affordable and available to the average Chinese citizen. Brownell says China, unfortunately, is beginning to resemble the United States in that regard. For Only a Game, I'm Ann Donahue in Beijing.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Italy is among the many countries rewarding athletes who win Olympic medals, and one of Italy's winners, Francisco Daniello, made a bid this week to increase his reward. Mr. Daniello won a silver medal in double trap shooting on Tuesday and quickly suggested to the Italian government that they should pass a law exempting the prize money awarded to athletes from taxes. "We athletes go through major sacrifices," Mr. Daniello said, "and to remove the taxes from what we get here would be a very good thing." There is no truth to the rumor that the Italian government responded by saying, "Put down that gun and we'll talk." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce goes for the gold in the Olympic irony competition. Or maybe he goes for the iron. But first, one of America's best track and field athletes is currently wearing the red, white, and green. Andrew Howe is representing Italy at the Olympics, even though he was born in the USA. He's a speedy sprinter who, because of injury, is limiting himself to the Olympic long jump competition, which holds its preliminaries this morning at National Stadium in Beijing. Howe, who won silver at last year's World Championships, hopes to bring home a medal to Italy, which has embraced him as its own. From Rome, Nancy Greenlease reports.
Appearances can be deceiving, at least when you meet Italy's great Olympic hope.
Hi, my name is Andrew Howe. I'm a long jumper for Italy. In italiano. Ciao, mi chiamo Andrew Howe. Insomma, faccio salti lungo per l'Italia.
The man with the physique of a Roman god grew up in Rieti, a small Italian city. But he says Americans assume he's from the Bronx, while Italians think he's from Africa.
Well, because I'm like half black and half white, so they're like, usually Italian guy, you know, dark hair, blue eyes, you know, kind of olive-colored skin and stuff like that. So, you know, like, you don't look the Italian and stuff like that. So they call us black Italians, you know.
His mother is American with Caribbean roots. His father is a former soccer player of German origins. Andrew, born in Los Angeles, immigrated to Italy at 4. His mother was then married to an Italian. The little boy grew up here, going to school, landing a girlfriend, learning to drive, all the formative experiences that make him as Italian as pizza, pasta, and Pavarotti.
I think like an Italian. I act like an Italian. I speak like an Italian, a very big Italian. And I don't know, I mean, I think it's in the heart mostly. I think when you feel that it's inside yourself and it's in your heart, I don't think it really has to be inside your blood.
He's Italian with the American subtitle. That's what I call it.
Renee Felton is Howe's coach, masseuse, agent, and mother. And she's contributed gold medal genes to his Olympic pursuit. In the 1980s, she held a U.S. junior college record in hurdles. She moved to Italy in the late 80s to compete on the European professional track circuit. About the same time, she saw signs that her son might follow in her footsteps.
He knew at the age of 4 he was going to be a great track and field athlete. On this oval with white lines is what he used to call it. I want to go on that big thing with white lines. And one day I'm going to be the best in the world here.
A breeze blows off sparkling Lake Bracciano as Howe and a buddy jog around an empty track at the base outside Rome, where he trains for a military team. Up the hill is a medieval castle, lately famous for hosting Tom Cruise's star-studded nuptials. Howe admits he gets A-list treatment here. He trains on a duplicate model of the Beijing jump pit and never has to fight for space.
I kind of like it, you know, to kind of feel like it's my track, you know, kind of like comfy and stuff like that. Because it's so peaceful and, you know, you can really, really concentrate on yourself. And that's the main thing in our sport.
Here he leads a highly structured, almost monastic life of running, sleeping, and eating. One that he hopes can help take him to higher places.
Well, I think he's exceptionally talented.
That's Santa Monica Track Club coach Joe Douglas, who has a family history with Andrew and his mom. He coached Renee and has given tips on jumping to Andrew, both in Italy and the U.S.
He chooses to stay focused and disciplined for 36 years. I believe he'll be a great one. He may be the next Carl Lewis. Providing there's no injuries.
And Douglas should know. He coached 9-time Olympic gold medalist Carl Lewis in the 1980s. Douglas says Howe would be a Team USA star. At the recent Golden Gala meet in Rome, Howe had a large cheering section, even though he pulled out of the event to recover from a thigh injury. Assane Diouf, a Senegalese immigrant, came to see Howe, whom he says is much more than an athlete.
Truly, he is a wonderful person. Fantastic. I hope that he's able to do many great things.
Diouf says one of his biggest achievements is leaping across the racial divide. Italy's largely homogeneous population has bristled at the soaring numbers of African illegal and legal immigrants.
I believe Andy will truly help the races integrate. Italians will no longer see black men, men of color, as frightening. Instead, they'll get to know them through sports.
Howe says he's never faced discrimination. He credits his willingness to acclimate to the culture. Personally and professionally, it's paid off. Howe is the new face of Italy, unusual for a track star. He shills for Fiat, Nike, and does spots for one of Italy's biggest chocolate producers. Howe is buying the last candy bar from a vending machine when a woman cuts in front of him. Then she recognizes him. She begs him for his autograph and manages to slip away with his chocolate bar. He smiles and says it's great to be famous. Howe admits he's living la dolce vita in this small country where his every achievement is celebrated and rewarded. He says he has respect for the U.S., but would feel like a traitor jumping borders.
Absolutely. I mean, I could never, like, you know, switch colors. I don't even know the American national anthem off by heart. You know, people would shoot me. You know, but I know the Italian one off by heart, you know, and that's a big thing over here because not a lot of people know about my Italian anthem off by heart. So, you know, me, you know, black, you know, knowing the Italian anthem off by heart is very funny.
Howe will compete in today's long jump preliminaries at Beijing's National Stadium. He may sing loud and proud from the podium on Monday. If that happens, he says he'll have to get ready for the party. His country will host a showstopper for its adopted son. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Rome, Italy.
Andrew Howe isn't the first athlete to compete in the Olympic Games for a country that was not originally his own. Some, like the 10 Canadian members of Italy's most recent Olympic ice hockey team, swap nationalities because they aren't quite good enough to compete for their home country. Others, like Saif Saheed Shaheen of Qatar, who used to be Stephen Chirono of Kenya, do it for money. Saif, nay Stephen, reportedly will receive $1,000 a month for the rest of his life for taking an entirely new name and competing for Qatar in the steeplechase. Lawrence Dunnigan is covering the Olympics for the Guardian newspaper, and he joins me on the line from Beijing. Lawrence, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Probably the case to receive the most attention this Olympics is that of J.R. Holden, who's playing basketball for the Russian team. Holden has no Russian ancestry that I'm aware of, but he has a $1 million contract with CSKA Moscow. He was asked to play for the Russian team by Vladimir Putin himself, albeit through an interpreter. What? There's no language proficiency test when becoming a citizen of a foreign country for purposes of basketball playing?
If you can swish a three, Bill, you're in, I think. That's the rule. I spoke to J.R. Holden this week, and he is unabashed about it. As far as he's concerned, he's American in every aspect of his life except for basketball. Yes, he has a Russian passport. He takes it with him everywhere, but he uses his American passport. His Russian passport has never been stamped. He's a proud Pittsburghian. He did actually get offered a minimum contract in the NBA with the Memphis Grizzlies, but I think the minimum in the NBA is, what, $220,000? And as you say, CSKA, as they're known, are paying him $1 million a year.
Russia isn't going to win the gold medal in men's basketball, but nevertheless, the image that comes to my mind, if they manage to do so, would be J.R. Holden singing the Star Spangled Banner while they play the Russian anthem.
I would love to hear that. There's a quiz show back in Britain in which is called I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, in which people are asked to sing one song to the tune of another. I really would love to hear that. Although this has a kind of serious side to it. For instance, I'm at the table tennis arena today. It's amazing. China are dominating everything. But it turns out of 56 countries in the table tennis events, 18 of them have Chinese nationals playing for them. So there is a real trade in, you know, great athletes who can't actually play for their own nation moving to other countries. And you have to wonder, you know, what does that mean for the Olympic Games? It was meant to be a competition between nations, but in fact, there's no such thing.
I wonder whether the result of this trend will be that table tennis will improve in the countries where these Chinese immigrants are playing, or whether the people who would otherwise play in those countries just shrug and say, they're just going to have Chinese people playing under our flag.
That's exactly what's happening, Bill. It's happening to the extent of the God, I know more about this than I really should. The International Table Tennis Federation are introducing a rule after Beijing which says that anyone over the age of 21 cannot change countries. And anyone under the age of 21 has to stay in the country of their new country of choice for 3 years before they're allowed to play for their new country of choice. Not that I will care about this after the Olympics, because I'll go back to doing what I normally do, which is golf.
Much was made this week of Georgian beach volleyball duo Christine Santana and Andresa Chagas beating the Russian duo and knocking them out of the Olympic Games. Russian troops are currently occupying Georgia. Political pundits saw the match as proof that sport can overcome war. But wait, Santana and Chagas, those just don't sound like Georgian names somehow to me.
You're incredibly perceptive, Bill. You'd be even more perceptive if you said they were Brazilian. Of course, beach volleyball is another one of these events in which we all turn up. We think it's marvelous, but we really don't know much about. And, of course, nobody knew that these two women weren't Georgian. So we wrote it up as this great kind of conflict, you know, war by another name. And, of course, it turns out afterwards that the two Georgians were from Brazil. This was pointed out by one of the Russian players who was, as we would say in Scotland, was in a huff because she had been beaten. I mean, it's a serious business what's going on in Georgia, but it was quite a kind of funny sight. And, of course, there's this back and forth between the Russians and the Georgians slash Brazilians. But, again, it is remarkable. The more you kind of delve into these teams, you look around and you just discover that every country in the world is doing it. So it's just not, you know, small countries. I mean, Britain have people who weren't born in Britain. United States have Lisa Huber is a South African tennis player who's playing for the United States in the women's doubles event. So it's everywhere.
There was elation in the Only a Game offices early this week when we saw that the small West African nation of Togo had earned its first Olympic medal, bronze, in the whitewater kayak by Benjamin Boukpeti. Do you think the Togolese are disappointed that their first Olympic medal was won by a Frenchman who only visited Togo once when he was an infant?
Well, I can't speak for the great nation of Togo, I have to say. For instance, Scotland doesn't have its own. We're part of Great Britain. But, you know, if Scotland's a very small nation, I would like to think it would add to a sense of national pride if the person who came through and did something incredible on this world stage, if he came from my country, was born and raised in my country, shared the same experiences as me, if he was, for instance, a beach volleyball player from Scotland and won a silver medal or a bronze medal at the Olympics, that would heighten the sense of achievement and satisfaction for me. Now, I don't say that in any kind of po-faced way. It's just the way I feel about it.
Well, it sounds to me as if you and I are united in fuddy-duddy-dum or something like that, because the world is getting smaller and smaller, the distinctions between nations becoming less and less, but, you know, yeah, you want your Olympic athletes to actually have some sort of connection to the country for which they're playing, yes?
Well, I think it's, I mean, we have enough world championships, don't we? We have enough, you know, in tennis we have the four Grand Slams. We have enough of that, and these are all great. I mean, you think the one thing about the Olympics, it is uniquely, or it is meant to be uniquely about nations. And, of course, it really isn't. So what you're having is this big amorphous kind of mush-up, as we call it, of people just competing across boundaries. And what you have is then not a competition between nations, but a world championship, which is a great thing in itself, but it's not the Olympics, really.
Is amorphous mush-up a technical term?
No, I know. I think it's something we say in Scotland when we're slightly drunk.
Lawrence Dunnigan is covering the Olympics for the Guardian newspaper. Lawrence, thank you very much for joining me.
Listen, thanks for having me on, Bill. All the best. Take care.
You're listening to Only a Game. In last week's discussion with Charlie Pierce of protest zones in Beijing, Charlie took U.S. television producers to task for using Tiananmen Square as a backdrop for their shots. This provoked Nancy Cadet, who hears Only a Game on WRNI in Rhode Island, to send us an email. I loved your conversation with Charlie about the political implications of the sports coverage of the Olympics in Beijing, she wrote. Your show is consistently honest and refreshing, and this week was one shining example. Responding to another segment in that show, the one in which I discussed the proper pronunciation of Beijing with a couple of language teachers calling themselves two Chinese characters, Robert Funk wrote, "You and your guests completely ignored the process of Anglicization, in which speakers of English adapt a foreign word to English pronunciation." Mr. Funk wondered if we would next insist that Americans should say Paris instead of Paris, and perhaps even Deutschland instead of Germany. On the other hand, John Sayer wrote that people who say Beijing make him want to say Arg! Don't people listen to Chinese speakers, he asked, rhetorically, I assume. Kevin Weidenbaum, who hears the program on WCPN in Cleveland, also had language on his mind when he emailed this week. This is the bit of last week's program to which he was responding. You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or take a closer listen, Mr. Weidenbaum wrote. Doesn't that grate on your ears as an English professor? But you're not the only one on NPR who uses listen as a noun. Yes, I am being picky and fussy, but you could have easily said if you want to listen more closely. Otherwise, another great show. It's such fun to hear that people are giving us a close listen. I mean, listening closely. Should you wish to correct, congratulate, or clobber us for something you've heard, you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. The easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org, and you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After beating Nuria Llagostera of Spain in a tennis match at the Olympics, China's leading player, Zheng Jie, noted that some of the Chinese fans were not entirely knowledgeable about the game. Said fans apparently clapped when Ms. Llagostera double-faulted and sometimes burst into applause when rallies were still in progress. Both behaviors are generally considered poor etiquette for tennis fans. Sometimes they may cheer too early, said Zheng Jie. I hope the next time maybe they can pay attention to that. But nobody could hear the last part of what she said over the ooing, eyeing, and clapping.
I was just exhausted from the act of being polite. Yes, I was just exhausted from the act of being polite.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a ride aboard the Toms River to the Williamsport Little League Express. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The so-called Redeem Team crushed Greece 92-69 on Thursday. The American men's basketball team, which is undefeated in preliminary play, will take on Spain today and Germany on Monday. Have the men finally found that magical formula for international competition?
Well, they haven't found the magical formula for slogans and nicknames because Redeem Team is really stupid. But, I mean, they have found the formula, which is basically to play defense as well as your athletic abilities allow you. And whether this is Mike Krzyzewski or whether this is just the unique group of people who've had enough when they play defense the way they can, no team in the Olympics can come within 25 points of them.
The Spanish men's basketball team came under withering criticism for a team picture in which all the players are pushing at the corners of their eyes. I ask you, are these guys racist or just dumb as 15 bags of paella?
When did that become mutually exclusive, by the way? That's what everybody's been saying about this story.
Racist or dumb?
Yeah,
should be racist
can't
be, and dumb.
You can't be dumb and a racist. No, you're being a racist and you're being dumb.
So you don't go along with Pau Gasol, who said it was something that was supposed to be funny.
Pau Gasol is a professional athlete in the United States of America. Pau Gasol should know better. Pau Gasol has to go around the country next year and explain this to every city with a substantial Asian American population, which is to say all of them.
The U.S. women require no redemption and no revenge or anything like that, having behaved quite well and having won every gold medal since women's basketball became an Olympic sport. Are they sufficiently motivated to keep that streak alive?
This is a really, really good bunch this time. And again, along with the men, the women figured this out a few Olympics ago. If you play defensive basketball to the utmost of your athletic ability and you play it just as hard as you play offensively, no team in the world can stay with you. And we had this game against Mali, which they won by 56 points. Mali scored 5 points in the third quarter and 8 points in the fourth quarter. If you're keeping score at home, that's 13 points in the second half. 13-point halves isn't getting it done.
No. What's the likelihood that when Roger Federer retires, he will be known as the greatest tennis player never to have done much of anything at the Olympics?
Now, the Olympic tennis is very bizarre. Most people play it like it's a glorified exhibition. And this is pretty much what he did in losing to James Blake. Who thereupon went out and lost his next match.
Of course.
But the only person I saw that actually took it seriously was Steffi Graf in 1988, and she was coming off a Grand Slam. And she went and played seriously and won an Olympic gold medal, which gave her a Grand Slam plus a gold medal. I don't know if anybody's ever going to do that again. She had a great time playing it seriously.
All right, I will now riddle you this. When is trash-talking not trash-talking? And the answer is not after you win.
It's when you can pass a polygraph saying you will win. Kelly Sutherland, a British heptathlete, has convinced herself that she's going to win the heptathlon. And as evidence for her case, she passed a polygraph that said, yes, you will win the heptathlon at the Olympics. Now, I suspect we're going to be moving into other areas, and pretty soon you're going to have athletes consulting the Magic 8-Ball. Yes, it seems likely. Ask again later. Like, after you play!
Chinese rower Zhang Liang missed the opportunity to compete at the Olympics when he showed up late for his race on Tuesday. What worries me is the last line of the story where I read about this poor guy. It reads, quote, "There's no further report about whether Zhang will be punished for his mistake." What, losing the opportunity to compete wasn't punishment enough?
No, let's go to the Magic 8-Ball. Yes, it seems likely. This is a bad thing when it happens to people whose governments don't control their entire lives. It's much worse when it happens to someone whose government does control his entire life.
All right, you feel like we should get away from the Olympics for a while now?
Sure, absolutely.
Here we go. On Tuesday morning, the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame announced its class of 2008. Quick quiz for you here. Which member of that class was most often told as a young player, you can't play in the tournament?
Well, let's eliminate Brett Hull. Right away. Okay, just because I suspect suspect nobody ever said that to
tournaments.
Brett
Hull. They said, we'll have it whenever you can make it.
Now, that would have to be Cammy Granato, whose brother Tony, of course, was a hockey player. And Cammy Granato, a groundbreaking figure in women's hockey, is going into the Hall of Fame with Brett Hull, Mike Richter, and Brian Leach.
On Thursday, the National Football League made its debut in Toronto,
woo-hoo,
where the Bills beat the Steelers in exhibition play. I think I can say exhibition. We're our friends.
We're National Public Radio. We can say exhibition. What are they going to do, take away our broadcast contract?
Were our friends north of the border mesmerized by the running, the passing, the kicking, the things of that nature?
Hey, they were 5,000 short of capacity. Everybody was disappointed. 48,000 is not a bad crowd, though, considering that the ticket prices went from $75 to $575 for, yes, exhibition football.
Charlie, after your house is broken into, it is customary to tell the police what has been stolen, but do you suppose Philadelphia Eagles tackle Broderick Bunkley is thinking he might have been better off if he just provided a general sense of what was missing rather than that itemized list?
Hey, Bill, if you had a PlayStation 3, an Xbox 360, a Nintendo Wii, and $600 worth of camcorder, wouldn't you need two Desert Eagle 50 caliber handguns, an Armalite rifle, a custom-made 223 caliber rifle, a 45 caliber Glock handgun, and ammunition for all of them to keep them safe, which you couldn't do because people not only stole them, but stole the guns, too?
Stole the guns as well. This guy is surely going to have a new nickname when the next season begins.
I'll tell you what, I don't want to be accused of being soft on crime, but these burglars had guts.
John McEnroe has apparently regained his 1980s form. What did he do at his Hall of Fame Champions Cup match on Thursday to achieve that?
Well, he was cursing and arguing with the chair umpire, and when the crowd, which planned on like coming to see like old guys play tennis, didn't like it. This is at the internet. This was at, by the way, at the Hall of Fame Champions Cup in the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, by the way. Johnny Mac responded by their heckling him by flipping them off and then leaving the arena play. If this isn't topic A every time he does a broadcast for NBC next year, I'm going to be very disappointed.
And finally, Charlie, please tell us why Doris Probst is celebrating this week.
No, I won't. Hog calling is not sport. I am sorry. Except in Arkansas, hog calling is not sport. Anyway, she won the 2008 hog calling contest. Apparently, she beat a guy named Nathan Broadus, who mimicked the lifelike sounds of what a disgruntled sow or newly castrated baby boar sounds like. I suspect that not only was the sow disgruntled, but the newly castrated baby boar wasn't doing so well either. They probably sound a lot alike. I did like the third place guy because what he did was call his pig on his cell phone.
Hmm. Who knew that this question would elicit such a multi-layered answer? I'm just thrilled. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Woo! Pig! Suey! I knew that would happen!
Six Good Innings, subtitled How One Small Town Became a Little League Giant, tells the story of the 2007 All-Star team from Toms River, New Jersey. That team aspired to play in the Little League World Series, the 2008 edition of which began yesterday. Toms River is not a representative town with regard to its Little League team. The town had sent aggregations to the Little League World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania before, and the 1998 team from Toms River won the extravaganza. The Toms River coach, John Puglio, began the 2007 season by spreading an enormous aerial photograph of the Little League complex in Williamsport on the ground before his players. That's one of the scenes Mark Kreidler describes in Six Good Innings. He joins me now from the studios of KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Welcome back to Only a Game, Mark.
Great to talk to you, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Describe for us what Coach John Puglio and his colleagues were trying to do when they spread that aerial photograph of Williamsport on the infield at Toms River.
A little bit of subtext there is probably helpful, and that's that the summer before, John had coached this essentially this same group of kids as 11-year-olds. Now, in Little League, you can go to Williamsport when you're 12. When you're age 11 or younger, you still do get to compete in all-star tournaments, and those are on, you know, local and regional levels. They had a wonderful run, went all the way to their state tournament in New Jersey. So the bar had thus been raised for his team. By spreading out that photograph, John really believed that he was helping them understand you're capable of going to this level. It really neatly summarizes exactly how Toms River, New Jersey approaches Little League. They want to be in Williamsport. Most towns wouldn't even ponder Williamsport except on television. In Toms River, Williamsport is actually what they think they can achieve. And I think that's what John was getting at with the photograph.
Puglio's players practiced for 56 straight days, often twice a day, sometimes for several hours at a time. The practices, you write, were heavy on repetition, devoid of flair. Did any kid or any parent ever say, hey, you know, a day off wouldn't be a bad idea?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that came up. In fact, one of the mothers who I spent a fair amount of time with is a physical therapist by trade. And she really openly worried and worries in the pages of Six Good Innings as well about the long-term effects of never taking a break. And I think the point that she raised was actually a really practical one. You know, she wouldn't work 56 days in a row. She wouldn't go to work 56 days in a row. I certainly wouldn't. I think all of us would feel completely put upon if that were the case. And yet, for the kids, there was this excitement building over what they thought they could accomplish. And from the parents' perspective, there was this sense that much less than that would probably be ensuring defeat.
These players are, as you say, 11 and then 12 and 13 years old, and you write that the success of the team became, quote, the identity of the town itself. Was that a good thing?
Oh, I think not, in the main. I was very intrigued by the people that I met in Toms River because they, and this is going to come out sound a little strange, but they seemed so normal. When you meet the parents individually, when you meet the families individually, when you spend time in their homes, they're such, at least in my experience, such normal, well-adjusted, seeking, questioning parents. It's hard to imagine how any of us can find ourselves in a situation in which, through the middle of a brutal, humidity-soaked Jersey Shore summer, anybody could have decided, yeah, 56 days in a row, that's the way to go. And yet that's how it played out.
Well, you talk about these parents as normal. You were surprised at how normal they appeared to be. But still, when some of them learned what the tournament schedule would require of the Toms River players, this is the regional tournament, some of the parents became convinced that there was an anti-Toms River effect. That is, that the tournament officials had rigged the schedule to the disadvantage of their kids. This sounds like paranoia to me. Were they right?
I think that they were the recipients or victims, if depending on your view, of a bad random series of events. They did get a brutal schedule, the team that I covered in the summer of 2007. Their district tournament, which is the first level through which you have to pass if you want to ultimately go to Williamsport, their district is loaded with difficult teams. It's a huge baseball playing area. They did have bad luck in the draw. They drew difficult schedules. Weather conspired against them at one point and forced the kids to play back-to-back games, which is very difficult in tournament play because there are limits on what you can do with your pitching and all of that kind of stuff. Any grand conspiracy? I think probably not.
One of the players about whom you write is a kid named Chris Gulla. He's described in the local newspaper as a Greg Maddux-type player, which strikes me as a little bizarre for a 12-year-old, but moving right along. This kid hurts his arm. You allude to an alarming uptick in the reported number of cases of arm and elbow problems in young players. Are coaches like John Pulio really asking too much of these kids just in physical terms?
Actually, and that's a really interesting point. You know, I'm a Little League coach as well as the person who wrote this book, and I also coach in travel ball, and I can tell you that the uptick in arm injuries, particularly as they relate to young kids pitching, has much, much more to do with factors that are utterly outside of Little League's control than anything Little League is doing. Little League continues to be a national and international leader in trying to limit the number of pitches that any one child can throw in a given week. And that is a direct response to this uptick in injuries. But the injuries themselves, honestly, Bill, are the product of this explosive cottage industry, if you will, of year-round sports. And there are a million supplemental leagues and additional extracurricular, outside of Little League, travel leagues and competitive leagues. Doctors are seeing a huge uptick, for example, in the number of kids with heel injuries. Why? Because they never get out of their soccer cleats.
Mark, when you signed on to follow the Toms River team through the 2007 season, did you assume that they would make it to Williamsport again?
No, actually, I have to say I assumed the opposite. To get to Williamsport for a United States team, and the U.S., by the way, gets 8 out of the 16 entries at the Little League World Series. The entire rest of the world has to scramble for the other 8 berths. Still, to get one of those 8, you have to put together a local all-star team that can win its district, which is against the other towns in its area, then move on and win a level called the section. The next level is the state tournament. After that, they have to go to a regional tournament. You've got to win 4 straight tournaments just to get to Williamsport. If any one thing goes wrong at any of those stops, you have the same great team you always had, but you're not going to Williamsport. So I would argue that, in general, for the teams that get to go to the Little League World Series, not only is it a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but it is statistically a fluke. And for most towns, it's a one-team-in-a-lifetime experience. What happened in Toms River is such a statistical anomaly that I didn't go in with any expectation that they would get there. What I went in with was the understanding that they expected it was highly possible. And that expectation alone was enough to drive a narrative for a book.
The Toms River team is absent from the 2008 Little League World Series, which began yesterday. What happened?
Well, they ran into a buzzsaw in their district competition. Again, a loaded district in which the winner almost always eventually plays in the state tournament, and that happened again this year. But let me just tell you, Bill, that the 11-year-old team from Toms River
Uh-oh.
Not only won their district, but but went deep into their section playoffs. And so the dream begins anew for 2009. And I expect that I would be able to come back a year from now and tell you the same thing about 2010.
Mark Kreidler is the author of Six Good Innings, How One Small Town Became a Little League Giant. The book is published by Harper, and Mark Kreidler joined me from KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Mark, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill, so much.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle and from Mark Jones at KXJZ in Sacramento. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about Six Good Innings, view Nancy Greenlease's Andrew Howe photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Guardian journalist Lawrence Dunnigan, who defends his colleague's use of the highly technical term Olympic mashup.
It's something we say in Scotland when we're slightly drunk.
I think that's something we say when we drop the potatoes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.